And we return. It is today's Topical Currents, Tuesday edition. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. Well, today we visit with journalist Nathaniel Johnson. He's a young man raised in Northern California by parents totally committed to a natural lifestyle. That influence has stayed with him, but is tempered by adulthood, marriage, and a child. Nathaniel Johnson has written All Natural, A Skeptic's Quest to Discover if the Natural Approach to Diet, Childbirth, Healing, and the Environment Keeps Us Healthier and Happier. And he joins us from San Francisco. Welcome to you, Nathaniel.
Good morning. It's great to be here, and great job with that title. It's also a quest to have the world's longest subtitle.
I was going to mention that, but I figured I wouldn't, but it seems to be a trend with authors these days, too.
It is. It's a trend.
Well, we'll just shorten it as we go on to All Natural, A Skeptic's Quest. How's that?
That's great.
Welcome. Great to have you. Tell us a little bit about growing up in Nevada City, California.
Well, I grew up in this very small town that's home to communes and spiritual retreats and a lot of people just looking to get back to the land, kind of back to Eden, which is what my parents were looking to do. When we were living in the city and when we got old enough to start walking and, you know, my brother and I started skinning our knees on the concrete, well, this was man's corruption injuring the children, and so we had to move somewhere softer. And so this is, you know, the entire philosophy that my parents had was that instead of protecting ourselves against nature with technology, that we should really embrace nature. And I had this really lovely childhood in many ways. So this idea, I have a lot of sympathy for it.
And tell us about that seminal moment at age 5 at the lake when you realized you were different from your friends.
Right. Well, this is sort of the other shoe falling. This is the first moment that I really began to doubt that my parents' ideas were always best. And I thought, well, maybe there are some ways in which it's doing us harm. And this is, we just moved up to this little town, Nevada City, up in the foothills of the Sierra Nevada. And my parents took us to this potluck, and you can imagine it's a warm summer evening. The adults are batting at mosquitoes. There's casseroles out on a table, and all of the kids are swimming in this little lake out on this platform. They're pushing each other off, and so me and my brother swim out there as well, and we pull ourselves onto the platform, and we're ready to take everyone on, and instead of rushing us, everything just stops. And this little girl shouts, "They're naked! They're naked!" Because, of course, in my household, you know, naked is natural. We didn't wear swimsuits. And they all dove off the opposite side, and they swam for shore. And it was like one of those 1950s horror movies, you know, where this crustacean monster comes and terrorizes the beach party. And I was all alone on this platform. And it was the first moment. It was kind of this mortifying, sad moment for a little 5-year-old Nate. And it was the first time that I started to wonder, well, maybe some of these ideas about nature always being best are really actually doing me harm.
Now, your father also insisted, and this must have been a mess, that you and your brother, when infants, wouldn't wear diapers, and also some dietary restrictions, of course. Tell us more.
Yeah, so his idea, which came from Ida Rolf. Ida Rolf is the German masseuse who pioneered Rolfing, which I don't know if you've heard of, but it's this incredibly painful, you know, breaking down the tissue. And her idea was that when babies have these diapers on and they wear them every single day at precisely the time when the bones are most flexible and developing fastest, that it can make children bow-legged. And my dad said, well, this makes a lot of sense. So the answer is just to not wear any diapers at all, even the organic cotton, all-natural kind, and they would just follow behind us and wipe things up. So that was sort of one of the more extreme levels of commitment. And in terms of the dietary stuff, they're very firmly committed to keeping sugar out of the household. And this really became a sticking point when I was a little bit older and I began to discover that sugar existed and my friends got things like ringdings and ho-hos, and I wanted some of that too. And so I really began to dig into the literature and say, you know, is sugar really that evil?
And how old were you when you were looking into that?
Well, my initial forays into science, I have to admit, were pretty pretty rudimentary. And, you know, that this was like as a 13-year-old going and checking out a book at the library. But I think I've become a little bit more sophisticated over the years, and I've continued to do this.
Other than diapers and sugar, which you went without, there were a lot of other things you went without that most children had. What were they?
Well, let's see. I'm just technology in general was kind of thought of as an evil to be avoided. So we didn't have a television in the house. They made sure that there weren't too many little gadgets. Eventually, my parents broke down and bought a computer, and they realized that the world was changing around them, and they needed to stay up to pace a little bit. But we had very strict rules for using the computer. We kids had to be outside for 3 hours every day for every half hour that we spent on the computer. And so this meant that we spent a lot of time outside, you know, even on the coldest, windiest, rainiest days.
Yeah, that was kind of an interesting thing when you were waiting to use the computer for half an hour and it was snowing, I think it was. You were like 9?
Yeah. Yeah, me and my little brother, I start the book with this anecdote of me and my little brother outside, and it's the sleet is coming down, and it's not quite snowing, but it's that kind of rain where it's so cold, it's just on the verge of snowing, and because there's so much humidity in the air, it almost feels colder than if it were really, you know, those nice, flaky, quiet flakes coming down. And we're huddled together on the back deck with our backs up against the door and this dirty blanket over ourselves and our teeth chattering. And every few minutes, I'll turn and look at my little brother Tim and I'll say, "Okay, how far have we gotten?" And he'll pull out this little clock and, "All right, that's been 8 minutes."
How did this lifestyle affect you when you got into high school, where there's much more peer pressure?
When I got into school, it started really in middle school. The first thing I noticed was, of course, the lunchroom, because I would come in with my slice of bread, very dense whole wheat bread with maybe a little Lebanon bologna on it, and a, you know, kind of misshapen garden-grown carrot, and there would be these other kids there with these beautiful Lunchables that were just perfect at the moment of unwrapping, and these Snickers bars and just these wondrous food creations that I thought, man, why would I opt for this stuff that, you know, maybe there's bugs in, and instead of having these wonderfully man-made, technically perfect foods that just seem so delicious and so safe. So that was one aspect. And of course, then there was the whole pop culture aspect as well, where, you know, because I didn't have a television, everybody else was talking about Saturday Night Live. And, you know, it's like someone would ask me if I liked Michael Jackson, and it would be, I'd feel like a spy in enemy territory. I didn't know the answer to this question, you know. And you had to know the answer to be cool. So it was kind of difficult there for a few years.
Nathaniel Johnson, let's move ahead. You marry a woman who, the daughter of a doctor, so she has a scientific background, and she becomes pregnant with your soon-to-be daughter. So you're faced with this midwifery versus hospital situation, and how did you resolve that?
Exactly. Yeah, I should say that we came from very different backgrounds. Obviously, she was born in Fort Lauderdale at a hospital, via C-section, and I was born at home in Berkeley, California, with a midwife. And when there are these pictures of the day after I was born, these beautiful black and white photos, and it just looks so idyllic. You know, there's the whole family is clustered together. It's warm. There are none of those wristbands that they give you to make sure that some psychopath doesn't steal the baby. None of the hospital towers, no gowns, just family at home, candles on the windowsill, music playing in the background. And this is really what I wanted for my kids as well. But then, you know, there's this complication that what my wife was comfortable with was very different. And so when I started to do the research on this, the first thing that I did was really interrogate my parents and find the full story of my birth. And I learned that my mother had actually had a postpartum hemorrhage after I was born. And it was something that was resolved immediately. There was a doctor there, and he was able to deal with it himself. But it was very scary for a few moments. My father really thought that my mother was going to die for a couple really terrifying moments. And so this shook me. And then I started doing the research, the scientific research, and it was only a few phone calls in when someone said, well, you know, at least in California, it's getting more dangerous to give birth. Maternal deaths during childbirth are actually going up. And this seems to be a trend around the country. And it does seem to be related in some ways to the increasing medicalization of birth. And so this just was head spinning for me because it seemed to back up some of the things that my parents were saying in some ways. But it was just so unexpected that this would be coming from the medical scientific community. I don't know how far in depth that we want to get into that, but that, you know, this is a whole fascinating puzzle.
Well, we definitely want to talk more about that. It's Topical Currents. We're speaking with Nathaniel Johnson. We want to go back to the whole childbirth thing and all the investigations you've done into midwifery and all that. He's a journalist, and the name of his book is All Natural, A Skeptic's Quest to Discover... Oh, A Skeptic's Quest. I'm going to stop there. And let's take that short break. We'll come back, take some calls, some emails, and please stay with us.
And it is Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. We continue our conversation with Nathaniel Johnson, talking about All Natural, A Skeptic's Quest. So, Nathaniel, what did you wind up doing as far as your daughter's birth?
Well, in the end, we vacillated. We we went back and forth. We studied all the science, we kind of were looking for something that was midway between the the scalpel happy hospital and just giving birth in a glen surrounded by rabbits and birds. And the problem was that when I started looking around for birthing centers in San Francisco, the ones that I found were all had names like, you know, Double Rainbow Power Woman, you know, or Jade Birthing. And it just kind of turned me off, because what I was really looking for was something like no-nonsense, evidence-based midwifery. And so kind of by default, we ended up going to our prenatal appointments at this hospital that was right near our house. And lo and behold, they happened to have a midwife-run birthing program in the hospital, and it was really a lot of what we were looking for. Very up-to-date practices, very focused on the comfort and health of the laboring mother, and just really lovely people. And in a lot of ways, it was a very good fit in the end.
I was pretty shocked to learn that childbirth is becoming riskier after we've had so much progress, it seems. Maternal mortality, shock, kidney failure, all rising. What's the problem, and is there a solution?
Right. Well, we should say that childbirth has gotten a lot safer in the long term. When you look back to 1900, the maternal mortality levels were just sky high, and obstetrical science has done an amazing job in improving things. But there is some evidence that perhaps we've gone too far in some ways, and this gets very complex very quickly. The problems are probably a lot of things having to do with obesity and heart disease, and but there are some problems that can be traced directly back to the increasing interventions, medical interventions into birth. Cesarean sections are related to one class of problems that are increasing almost exponentially in women. And so there are many solutions. People are doing a lot of good work right now in hospitals. And one of the really simple solutions, and to me one of the obvious solutions, is to look at ways to bring down the cesarean section rate.
And when you say there's a problem associated specifically with cesarean section, what problem are you talking about? Which one?
So there's a few different things. The scariest thing is something called placenta accreta, where the placenta grows through the scar left by a prior C-section. So on the next pregnancy, and this gets more dangerous if there's multiple cesarean section scars. So if someone has four kids, all by cesarean section, it's the last one that's really where her risk really goes up. And because there's so much blood moving through the placenta, when it's trapped in the wall like that, it just creates this open spillway to the whole circulatory system when the baby is born. And even in the best hospitals with surrounded by the best surgical teams, women sometimes die from this this problem. And this is something that's just gone up amazingly fast. It's increased more than eightfold in recent years. It was something that, you know, a doctor would see maybe once in his entire career, back 20 years ago, and now it's mm-hmm. something that's seen regularly in every major institution.
It's pretty scary. We're speaking with Nathaniel Johnson. His book is entitled All Natural, A Skeptic's Quest. If you want to join in the conversation, the number to call is 1-800-743-9576. That's 1-800-743-9576. Or you can email radio@wlrn.org. That's radio@wlrn.org. You call our dilemma this ecological anxiety. What is that exactly?
Right. Well, I think that is what everybody who listens to public radio feels, if I can make that summation.
Of course, you've worked in public radio.
Yes, I did. Yes. So at least maybe I'm tainted by West Coast public radio, but it's this feeling of when you go to the supermarket and you're trying to choose whether to buy the organic cabbage or the conventional cabbage and figure out, is it really worth the $2 more or not? And if you sacrifice and pay a little bit more, is someone else just going to, you know, blow through that savings by, taking a trip on their private jet? It's this feeling that the world is getting worse and there's nothing that we as individuals can do about it. And this is really the feeling that that I was grappling with from a very young age that ultimately led me to write this book, because it feels as if sometimes everything we're trying to do to make the world better is actually backfiring, and things are getting worse off. And so I really wanted to dig into that and see if that true, and what do we do about it if it is true in some ways.
And
well, I think that I think that it gets oversimplified. I mean, it's only true in these very specific instances. And so I think it's important to go through and evaluate the evidence and see where our technology is actually doing more harm than good. And I think that there's a lot of hope. And what I found over and over again was that when you got beyond the people who were just saying, let's push forward every day, more technology, things must improve, progress must go on uninhibited, you know, the sort of technological chauvinists on one side and the people who just said wanted to chuck it all and get back to the land on the other side, there are a lot of really interesting people in between who are navigating this space and saying, how do we use technology appropriately to make our environment a better place? How do we create rules and rituals around our new technology so that it really does make our lives better rather than kind of willy-nilly throwing wrenches into the system? The book is one story after another of these fascinating people who can see the big picture but also have the details right so that they're able to push forward technologically in all these different fields. And in nutrition, with Bruce German at UC Davis, who's looking at milk as this fascinating new model for figuring out what we should eat. In forestry, with these people who are finding ways to make the land productive and beautiful at the same time. All of these types of things that I just find very hopeful.
You studied with journalist and food guru Michael Pollan. What did you get from him?
A lot, to put it mildly. I was working at a small town newspaper in southern Idaho, and I was covering a lot of agriculture and just doing, you know, the small town newspaper stories about this farm wants to expand and the neighbors are worried about the odors and the flies and that kind of thing. And I had this feeling that I was kind of grasping around the edges with these stories at something that was much larger and more interesting. And then I started reading Michael Pollan's work on agriculture, and I thought, man, I want to do what this guy is doing. And I ended up going to UC Berkeley School of Journalism to study with him. And the thing that he taught me was to really learn how to tell a story, first of all, to get at these bigger ideas. And secondly, he taught me not to be afraid of being wrong and figuring out where you're wrong early and embracing it and learning how to incorporate the arguments that the opposition brings and make your own argument stronger or shift your argument to make it stronger. So he's really been an invaluable influence to me.
We're speaking with Nathaniel Johnson. His book is entitled All Natural, A Skeptic's Quest. Nathaniel, you'll be at Books and Books in Coral Gables. That's Thursday evening at 6:30 p.m.
That's right. And I'm also participating in this literary feast as well.
And that's at the Fort Lauderdale Public Library?
Yeah, or going on after Thursday throughout the rest of the weekend.
The 15th through the 18th. You can go on their website, I'm sure, and get more information.
So it's called the Fort Lauderdale Public Library Literary Feast. Is that it?
That's right. And then, yeah, and Books and Books on Thursday in the evening. And I'll be chatting with Hillary Gerber, who's a really interesting person, a midwife turned OB, and who's just a fascinating and funny person. She has a blog called Mom's Tinfoil Hat. So we come from kind of similar backgrounds,
right,
and it
right.
should be a lot of fun.
It's Topical Currents. We're going to take another short break. We'll come back and have more. Welcome back to Topical Currents, Tuesday edition. Bonnie Berman here with Joseph Cooper, and we're visiting with Nathaniel Johnson. He's a journalist. He contributes to NPR. He contributes to This American Life, too. His book is All Natural, A Skeptic's Quest. Let's turn to milk, Nathaniel. What was your finding about raw milk versus pasteurized milk?
All right. Well, raw milk, I think we should start with the premise, how this even fits in. And because the idea of pasteurization, this is not some new fringe technology that we're just taking on. This is something that has been around for, you know, a century and more, and is really seen as something that's very obviously helpful. And I started my research on raw milk because there are some people in my hometown who really think that raw milk is superior, that we should be drinking raw milk, and that the pasteurization is this harmful technology. And so I went about this by first of all looking into the claim that raw milk could cause problems. I mean, this seemed like the first sort of easiest thing to debunk. And there was an outbreak shortly after that in California, where a lot of people who happened to have been drinking raw milk all got sick around the same time. And, of course, the authorities assumed that it was the raw milk. But then when I went and started doing the detective work, there were some very strange things that I noticed, that one child would have had a cup of this milk and gotten sick, and another would have finished the rest of the bottle and been totally fine, and that they couldn't find any of the E. coli that was causing these sicknesses in the milk itself. And so this made me start to wonder, well, is there really something to this idea that that we've given pasteurization a free pass? And there is some science still in development, but very interesting science suggesting that raw milk may be protective in some ways against allergies and asthma. And there's very strong science suggesting that that because we've erected this wall of sterility around us, and we've gotten so far away from our microbial friends that, you know, we evolved in this microbial soup, and now we've really distanced ourselves from them, that's really causing some big problems for our health. And you know, when they've looked at people that who has less allergies, who has less of these autoimmune diseases, they find that kids who grow up on farms and kids who drink raw milk do have some protection. Now, when I went further into my research, I became more and more convinced that the case that I was looking at, these kids who'd gotten sick, were really sick because, indeed, they had drunk this raw milk, and there was this bad form of E. coli in that milk. And the discrepancies that I started to find could be explained because instead of the old model where you think of if you get one bad germ, you're going to get sick, what was really going on is that these were two ecosystems. There's this ecosystem of germs, good germs and bad germs in the milk, and it's coming into contact with this ecosystem of germs that is inside of all of us. And it was only in those cases where there was a niche opening for this E. coli to get into and thrive and cause a sickness that it caused these few kids to get sick, whereas other people were really fine. They developed an immunity. And so it's just a kind of fascinating way of thinking about it, to shift from this old disease model where it's like one bad bug is going to kill you, to thinking about ourselves as more of an environment and needing to manage our entire ecology in order to stay healthy.
How about your daughter? Does she drink pasteurized milk?
She does, yeah. You know, I know people who feed their kids raw milk, and some very smart people do it, but it scares the heck out of me after talking to other parents who've had kids who got sick. And there's just no real way to be sure. It's, you know, all of this is about balancing uncertainty. You know, on the other hand, there's no way to be sure I can protect her from from asthma and allergies and, you know, more serious autoimmune disorders like lupus or type 1 diabetes. In the end, I felt like the risk of her drinking raw milk was greater than this more hypothetical risk of these autoimmune disorders.
If you have a question or comment, you're certainly welcome to phone in 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN and email, that's radio@WLRN.org.
So, Nathaniel, what does your daughter eat? I mean, what is her diet? And how old is she, by the way?
She is 20 months old, a little over a year and a half. She's at the stage, she's running around, she's stringing words together and becoming very affectionate, which is lovely. And she eats, basically, she eats off our plates. You know, she eats a little bit of whatever we're eating, which is a lot of brown rice. This is heavily influenced by my upbringing.
Right.
A lot of, you know, usually the meal is some kind of starch, like a brown rice, and then a vegetable like kale or Swiss chard or string beans. And then some kind of protein, might be tofu, it might be sausages one day, and that's sort of the basic Nathaniel and Beth meal, and we'll give our daughter, little Josephine, little bits and pieces off our plates.
So you found that organic food was no more nutritious than non-organic food, right? Yet you maintain that organic food is healthier. Explain to us about that.
Right. Well, there's this study that came out recently, a meta-analysis looking at all of the data that they could find on organic food and on conventional foods. And the conclusion was that the nutrient levels were pretty similar, that there wasn't a significant difference. And this really made a lot of people incredibly angry, and they thought this couldn't be right. But it's actually not that surprising to me, because we can measure, it's quantifiable, we can measure these known nutrient levels in food, and it affects the bottom line for farmers. And so our farmers in this country are amazing. They're not going to simply ignore this if it's going to hurt them financially. And they figured out how to control the nutrient levels in their food. This is what I would find over and over again. When you look at the very small picture, when you look at just the individual nutrients in one carrot, there may not be a benefit. But when you look at the big picture, when you look at the difference between having a giant industrial farm that makes the environment more polluted and uglier versus an organic farm that makes its local environment more beautiful and healthier. When you look at a system that employs a giant industrial farming system that has one tycoon at the top employing, you know, almost slave labor, these thousands of miserable workers, versus a system that creates a strong middle class of independent farmers. There are many ways like this that I think organic food is healthier for us as a whole, as a society, for the body politic, and if you take the focus on the sort of selfish individual health of the body and look at the health of the community, I think it's undeniable that organic food is healthier.
We're speaking with Nathaniel Johnson, and it's on today's Topical Currents. We're going to take one more short break, and we'll come back and take some of your calls.
And it is today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, Nathaniel Johnson. Nathaniel, how about a website where people can learn more about you and the book?
My website is nathanieljohnson.org, and it's a bit, I mean, I think you'll find it if you Google Nathaniel Johnson All Natural, but my name is spelled a bit oddly. It's N-A-T-H-A-N-A-E-L rather than the normal This is what you get when you have slightly unusual parents.
Exactly.
It's the King James Version New Testament of Nathaniel.
Okay. So. Well, let's take a call or two. First up, we have a Boynton Beach caller. This is Beverly. Hi there.
Hi there. I do apologize for, actually, I had tuned in late, but you had mentioned something I was hoping you could weigh in on a little bit more, and that is the pasteurization of milk. I had heard, I'm getting ready to read it, a book called The Devil in the Milk versus the A1 versus the A2 gene, the controversy, and how pasteurizing right. enacts a kink in the gene, and how we used to have Guernseys, but now we have Holsteins. I was hoping you could comment on that.
Well, you're pretty deep into this. This is deeper than most people get. And I actually haven't read that book, and so I don't know about there's these issues with this gene mutation in different dairy cows that may have some implications for health. And the bulk of the milk that we drink today with our Holsteins has this difference in it, and I don't know if there's anything to it or not. I really haven't delved into it, and you know, as a good skeptic, I have to remain open to it, and I'm very interested in it, and I'd love to find out more. That's the short answer.
Yeah, I know. I appreciate that. I know that there's a whole controversy, and when I haven't started reading it yet. But it all makes sense. I know there's been so many health issues, and I've had health issues from milk and wheat, and I just thought it was interesting and thought you might be able to comment a little more on it. But thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks for your call.
Thank you. Another controversial subject, you devote a lot of time to dealing with the vaccine issue. What are your conclusions mm-hmm. about that?
Well, vaccines... I just want to tell the story a little bit because it's something that is so quickly polarizing that if you come right out and say where your conclusions are, you quickly lose the other side.
Right. Tell
and
us.
I really started out worried about vaccines. In my hometown, a lot of people don't vaccinate. There's a school in my hometown with under 20% vaccination rate now. And there's just this feeling that here you are, you're trusting this giant corporation to create something and then get it injected into your arm, and you really don't know what it is. And I was really surprised when I went and did the research. I was working with a friend of mine who grew up in the same town, and she was trying to figure out what she should do for her son. She wasn't vaccinated when she was growing up. And we went together and we traced down every theory that we'd heard about and every fear. And it was just amazing to find out how much really solid science there was debunking every fear that I could find. And so in the end, I really felt comfortable with vaccines and actually came to see them almost as natural, you know, because we used to have this this communion with animals. You'd get cowpox, and that would protect you from smallpox. And there was this exchange of microbes across the ecosystem. And we've cut that off in many ways. And vaccination is a return to that communion. It's a way of safely exchanging this genetic material. The other thing that I should say about that is that there's just so many huge misconceptions out there. So many of these things, with just a little bit of scientific know-how, when I went and checked them, were so easy to debunk. I mean, there are these myths out there that just survive because no one's bothered to do a Google search. So it's something that at this point I feel very comfortable taking Josephine in for her vaccinations.
And you got a flu shot this year.
Yeah, this was the first year that I'd ever gotten a flu shot because of the book and because of the baby.
You talked about a really fascinating study from the Harvard Medical School conducted by Ted Kapchuk.
Kapchuk, yeah.
Kapchuk with the CARE effect. Would you talk about that a little? Because that was pretty amazing.
Yeah, so this came out of this larger feeling that you go to the doctor and you come away kind of feeling cold and as if not everything that as if you weren't fully treated. And this is a feeling that I certainly had with the medical system, and is something that certainly inclined me and a lot of people in my community toward alternative medicine. And so as I was looking into this, I came across this study by Ted Kapchuk at Harvard. And what he was doing was trying to zero in and figure out what were the different parts of that exchange with a doctor that really made people feel better and were healing. And he was able to isolate just the interaction, just the human interaction with the doctor. And the way he did it was pretty ingenious. He structured a study around acupuncture, and he had people come in to get their acupuncture, but they weren't actually getting acupuncture. The needles were fake needles that retracted into themselves, so it felt like basic acupuncture needles, but they weren't actually penetrating the skin. And he divided his test cases into two groups. One group that came in, and the practitioner said, "I'm not going to say anything to you because I don't want to bias the study." And they quickly and efficiently went about their business of doing the acupuncture, and then the people left. And these were all people with irritable bowel syndrome. And the second group, they came in and the practitioner sat them down and took a history and asked them how they were feeling and what they made of their illness and what they thought the causes were, and really listened to them and expressed care, and then gave them the treatment. And the difference between these two groups was just amazing. The people that actually got the care itself did better than people on the best pharmaceuticals that we know of. And the people who just got the sort of the cold care showed basically no improvement at all. And so this is this indication that caring is a really important part of the healing arts.
Bedside manner.
Say that again.
Bedside manner.
Yes, exactly. The bedside manner. And this, you know, feelings are not something that Western medicine deals well with. Bedside manner has gotten kind of short shrift in recent years. You know, I talk about the images that we have of doctors in the media. You think of like Dr. House as the person who doesn't care about bedside manner at all, but while everybody else is dithering with their feelings, he cuts through and comes up with a brilliant solution that fixes
Nathaniel
everything
Johnson,
in a snap.
We're just about out of time. We want to remind people, Bonnie,
yes,
the Books and Books
Nathaniel
business.
Johnson will be talking about his book, All Natural, A Skeptic's Quest, at Books and Books in Coral Gables, Thursday evening at 6:30. And he'll be at the Fort Lauderdale Public Library Literary Feast the 15th through the 18th. I don't know exactly when, but you can check out the dates.
I'm sure there's a website available. Thank you very much, Nathaniel. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Oh, the pleasure is all mine.
Thank you
so much.
Thank you.
And our apologies to those callers we couldn't get on the air. And that is our edition today. Producer is Richard Ive. Technical direction from Caroline Brader-Watts. Paul Leary is online producer. We have free audio archives and downloads of this and previous programs at our website, WLRN.org. And follow us as well on the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow at 1, it's live coverage of the Miami-Dade School Board meeting. Thursday, it's a special program with Linda Gassenheimer, her kitchen gadget extravaganza, with top picks from the huge Fancy Food Show. And to the calendar, on this day in 1933, 80 years ago, the first of President Franklin D. Roosevelt's radio fireside chats. He spoke about the need for bank holidays to temporarily halt cash withdrawals. And on this day in 1945, 68 years ago, the death of teenaged Jewish diarist Anne Frank in the Nazi Bergen-Belsen camp, just weeks before it was liberated. One more before we send in the clowns. On this day in 1980, 33 years ago, the murder conviction of serial killer John Wayne Gacy in Chicago for the brutal murders of some 33 young men, 26 of them found buried in the crawl space beneath his home. Gacy was executed in 1994 at age 52. Our theme music, created by Michael Levine. So we leave with a thought from young Anne Frank, whose father Otto survived the Holocaust and published the diary. Quote, "I don't want to have lived in vain like most people. I want to be useful or bring enjoyment to people, even those I've never met. I want to go on living even after my death." This is Joseph Cooper alongside Bonnie Berman. Thanks for making public radio your companion today. Stay tuned now for the Talk of the Nation.